Coming up on this edition of the Black Vault Radio, I sit down with legendary UFO researcher, Mr. Stanton T. Friedman.
If it had been ours, I believe the word would have been put out to keep your damn mouth shut. And everybody would have paid attention. Believe me, they would. People in power want to stay in power. New ideas come to be accepted. Not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them.
All that and much more. So stay tuned. The Black Vault Radio is about to begin. More than 20 years ago, I began a journey. My quest for the truth. My name is John Greenwald, and I have hammered the United States government with Freedom of Information Act requests trying to get answers. I have more than 2 million pages of declassified documents for you to download at theblackvault.com. Now, I attempt to dive even deeper and talk to some of the most brilliant minds on this planet. No government secret is off limits, and no question is off the table. All I aim for is the truth. This is the Black Vault Radio. Welcome, everybody, to the premiere episode of the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr., and I'm going to be honest with you, it feels awesome to be back on the air and finally getting this project off of the ground. This radio show, and I'm even apprehensive of calling it that because you'll hear in a moment I'm kind of not doing it the traditional way, but this audio channel is a phrase I like a little bit better than radio show or podcast. This audio channel is literally decades in the making. Now, for those of you who have followed my work and the Black Vault for quite some time, you'll know my history in radio. It started with hosting a show with my friend, the late Dr. Roger Lear. Dr. Lear really gave me my first shot back when I was about 17, 18 years old. I think I was 18. And he called me, introduced himself, and asked me to speak for his local MUFON group in Ventura, Santa Barbara, here in California. And I was excited. I mean, I'd never done that before. I had been on Art Bell around that time, but had never lectured before. And so I went out there and had a great time, met Dr. Lear. We hit it off. And as the years went on and our friendship continued, we ended up hosting a show together called Millennium Mysteries, and we had a lot of fun with it together. I miss that man. He did great work. He was obviously a pioneer when it came to the abduction phenomena and potential alien implants. We just had an all-around great time, and as my career kind of continued in television and so on, I did a rendition of the Black Vault Radio, which was broadcast for quite some time. And this is going to differ from that. There's going to be a lot of differences between this and that format for those of you who remember. Now, life got in the way. Sadly, I had to put that project on hold. I didn't plan on having it go for years on hold, but it did. Life kind of got in the way, and I had to put that on the back burner. But I'm really excited to say that that hold today comes to an end. I had aimed to do this in the beginning of 2018 in January. That was one of my New Year's resolutions. Sadly, I ended up in the hospital and spent about a week in for complications due to pneumonia. Didn't really advertise it that much, but I had some pretty severe complications. Spent some time in the hospital and got to know the nursing staff pretty well at my wife's hospital that she works at. And it wasn't a lot of fun, but I'm still, after all these months healing, they said it'll take over 6 months. But hey, you know what? There is no time like now. And I thought, this is it. This is the time. I love being interviewed on different radio shows, but it's time to really come back to making an audio channel that you guys want. And I've heard your frustrations. I've read it on comments, social networks, Twitter. I see what you guys want, and that's what I want to really aim to bring to you with the Black Vault Radio. Now, what is that? Well, you heard me say just a couple minutes ago that I did not want to call this a radio show. It is, but I kind of lean towards a very traditional format whenever I hear that term. And let's face it, there are 78 million options when it comes to podcast and radio shows. And I know, because I've experienced this myself, you guys will hear a good show, good interview, good momentum. And the minute it really starts to get good, the music comes on, a commercial break comes about, and you got to wait 5 minutes for everybody to come back, start talking again. The problem with that, when you're having a conversation, the momentum is gone. The break is there, and it really kind of breaks the momentum. Now, I get it. Commercials kind of are a necessity this day and age. But really, in the middle of an interview, what I want to do is kind of go straight through. And that's what you're going to hear today when I bring my friend and colleague on, Mr. Stanton Friedman. And that will be a characteristic of this show moving forward, where those interviews take place break free, except when they last more than an hour. That's just a courtesy to all of us, simply because, well, let's just face it, we need a break sometimes while we're doing a long conversation, and that's kind of the idea. I'm looking to profile some independent artists, figure out a fun way, but I'm not going to break it and, you know, go to a commercial for deodorant or anything like that in the middle of an interview. The show is also going to have a couple other segments, and that's really the format of this, and I wanted to take a minute or two before we get really started with the show, talking about the format of how this show is laid out. Now, obviously, you heard the tease already. You heard some sound bites and sound clips from Stanton Friedman, but also you're going to have a couple different segments before we get rolling here with Stanton. And the first and foremost, every week or every episode, I should say, because there actually will be more than one episode per week on some weeks, not all the time, but there will be where there's multiple episodes that are dropped onto theblackvault.com that you can listen to. But every episode is going to have a news segment. And the TBV news segment is literally just that, where there are headlines. I'm not trying to be a news show or a breaking news or anything like that. But rather, it's to keep tabs on the headlines that I feel that you guys should be aware of. They pertain to the topics that I will deal with here on the Black Vault Radio. Now, just so you know, too, this is not going to be just geared towards a UFO or paranormal realm. That is not what this show is. I'll deal with those topics, but rather, I am not trying to be the next UFO show or paranormal show. Rather, the Black Vault Radio tackles pretty much every government secret out there. All of those stories that you hear about, from historical aspects to the paranormal aspects to top secret military aircraft, all sorts of different topics I dive into. In essence, I'm taking that 2 million page archive that I have and I'm trying to bring it to life. Because I know deep down that those documents are not the complete story. There's no humanity behind that. There's no voice behind those records. And so my idea is to bring some of the most brilliant minds to use those documents as a starting point and then expand on them. Figure out what more to the story is there with these brilliant minds that I want to bring onto the show. So we're going to start with those headlines in the TBV News segment. The segment with our guest will be TBV Dialogues, and that is going to be the main brunt of the show. That's going to be the main length of it. That's where you're going to get the most talking back and forth. We aim for 1 hour interviews, but I'm giving the guest the option. If they don't have that much time, that's fine. It'll be a little bit shorter. If they want to go longer, even better. I will break it at the hour, maybe have some fun music or something like that. But the TBV Dialogues, we aim for at least an hour, if not two. And hey, if a guest wants to hang out for even longer, I'm all for it. So expect a longer show in the future. And lastly, a segment called TBV Unredacted. Now, what is this? Every episode out of those 2 million pages that I have, I'm going to be honest with you and say that sometimes I forget what the heck is in that archive. And I live it and breathe it, and I've created it. So if I forget, I'm thinking that maybe the audience may miss a heck of a lot in that archive. Reason is, it's just huge. I never imagined that it would get that big this fast. I mean, granted, it's been over two decades. But to have millions of pages and the effort to try and organize that for me, it's been challenging. It really has. So what I want to do with TBV Unredacted is just take a couple minutes every episode and profile a random document. Sometimes it'll be a document that pertains to the guest. That way it'll tie in and you can see some of the real information that's come out of the government. Other times it will just be literally just that, random, something new, something old, something I got 20 years ago and I totally forgot about. I'm looking for those random gems in my archive to profile every episode for you. Because I think that once I post it, maybe this is my fault and I shouldn't do this, but I just kind of don't feel like I should just keep posting it over and over, meaning a document goes up on Monday. I don't really post it again. And that might be a bad thing, but I mean, there's so much new stuff that I put online. Unless you guys want posts every 8 seconds, it would be kind of impossible to keep profiling this. So that's the point of that segment, is I want to really highlight those documents, the important ones that have a fascinating story. Because I will say this too, two things actually. Number one, it's not always the content of the document that is the interesting part. Sometimes it's the lack thereof that is the interesting part. Now, what do I mean by that? Sometimes it's the redacted portions, the blacked out stuff. That might frustrate you and think, well, why is that important? And a lot of times the fact that they're blacking out material tells part of the story. And as the episodes are posted, as I start exploring all of these documents, you will absolutely see what I mean. And the one this week, this episode, I think you will really enjoy because it's not redacted. And it tells a fascinating, fascinating story. And the fact that it's not redacted, I believe, plays a gigantic role into how important this topic is. But you're going to have to stay tuned to find out what document that is. Also, in the coming episodes, there's a document that will profile not necessarily the content of it, but the fact, if you can believe it, and I'm not exaggerating, the fact is I waited 14 and a half years for that document to arrive. Now think about that. Think how long that is. 14 and a half years after I filed the original request for that record, I finally got it. That is an insane amount of time. I mean, really think about how frustrating that is to wait 14 and a half years. But that is exactly what I had to do. So all those documents are coming up in the coming episodes of TBV Unredacted, plus a heck of a lot more. So that being said, thank you all for tuning in. We're going to get on with the show very soon with Stanton Friedman. But before we do, like I said, it's time for some headlines on TBV News. Up next in the TBV News segment, I want to speak just about a couple of things before we get going here. The show's probably a little bit longer, just simply because of the longer introduction to give you guys an idea about what the show is all about and kind of give you the rundown. But as we move forward, I'm not going to do that obviously every time, so it'll be a little bit shorter. But this time in the TBV News segment, I want to talk about a couple of things that you may have missed. Now, one of the topics that's going to be coming up here, not only with my friend Stanton Friedman, who's going to be joining me in the next few minutes, but also in the coming episodes, the topic of To the Stars Academy, led by former rock star or current rock star, whichever way you look at it, Tom DeLonge, and his efforts to bring out more UFO information. He's done that since last October with a big press conference, and he brought forward, and I give him a lot of credit for this, brought forward a man who headed a project within the Pentagon, investigating UFOs and unidentified aerial phenomena. Now, I have been skeptical about the scope of that, and I was very intrigued when it all went down last October, and then in December it really broke in the media. This is going to be something we talk about quite a bit, simply because it's going on now. It's all unfolding now, and that leads me to the first story here in the headlines is, just this week, just I think in the last 24 hours or so, let me see if I can get a date, The To the Stars Academy posted on Instagram and Twitter, and yes, it was posted on July 2nd, so just this week. To the Stars Academy posted a post. I should find a better way to say that. Posted our scientists, and this is a quote, "Our scientists are all smiles while welcoming Lou Elizondo and his delivery to their lab. Happy hashtag World UFO Day," and linked over to the Instagram photo. Now, Lou Elizondo, or Luis Elizondo, is the man who did head that UFO project. The photograph is Dr. Hal Puthoff, Mr. Elizondo in the middle, and Dr. Eric Davis on the right. Now, what did he deliver? And the reason is because then the Instagram caption of this: "Dr. Hal Puthoff and Dr. Eric Davis welcome Luis Elizondo to their laboratory in Austin, Texas. Everyone's excitement is palpable as the award-winning physicists prepare to inspect his delivery. Happy hashtag World UFO Day." Now, here's my criticism. Why tease it, right? What is he delivering? Now, I get it. We want to get a little bit of intrigue here and people talking and so on. But that really is the biggest criticism I have, is that if you have evidence, right, at least show it. This is a public benefit corporation and they are asking for your money, right? That's the whole point. They want you to give them your money to invest and be a stockholder. And yet here they are kind of teasing, you know, what, a piece of what, a specimen of what was his delivery? That's the kind of stuff that really frustrates me as an investigator, because if they are trying to do this for a public benefit, sadly, they're not benefiting the public by just simply teasing all of this stuff. So that being said, don't miss that photograph. Definitely subscribe to the Stars Academy. I mean, I'll give them the plug. I think you should follow them on Twitter. It is TTS Academy. And then on Instagram, it's To the Stars Academy. So follow them both. I mean, randomly, they send out this stuff. Who knows what that sample is or what will come of it, of anything. But definitely don't miss that, because that is the first time that they have tweeted in about a month, it looks like. So, you know, they're not very active sending out information. And when they do, you know, hey, it's interesting. So keep tabs on that. Another headline worth mentioning here in the last couple of weeks is paranormal investigator Joshua P. Warren. Now, recently I made an appearance in Las Vegas and was actually pretty honored to be asked by George Norrie and the producers Tom Danheiser and Lori Wagner of the event to appear at Coast to Coast AM Live in Las Vegas. I had a lot of fun with that. We had a great time on stage. But after the show, I got to meet Joshua Warren, and he introduced himself at the bar. He and I chatted for quite a long time, a very interesting guy, and had a lot of fun just kind of hanging out and relaxing a bit. And he told me about some of the experiments that he was doing. Now, I didn't know that he would kind of make a discovery around this time frame, but then within days of that event, I see a Las Vegas news story with Joshua Warren that he was using what's called a DT meter, and that stands for a differential time rate meter. Now, I'm not very privy to exactly what this device does, other than measure the amount of time it takes for a signal to get from this meter through a 100-foot cable with a sensor on the end to send the signal back. Now, really what this measures is just showing the amount of time that it takes for this signal to pass through. It will stay constant with this time where we are on Earth. Now, according to Joshua Warren, and this is a quote, "That signal is always supposed to travel at the same rate of time at any particular place. The only way that could change is if a black hole approached Earth or something like that, which is never supposed to happen. And yet, then, on June 18th in 2018, Joshua Warren actually measured on this device that time slowed down for 20 microseconds. Now, this was in the desert between the I-15 and Route 93. It's just north of Las Vegas. Now, if you're familiar with the area, there's also kind of another big thing in that general vicinity, and that would be Area 51. So it's interesting that he made this discovery out there. What does it mean? Was it a machine malfunction? Well, according to him, he hasn't registered this at all at any other time during any other experiment. Now, knowing Joshua Warren after talking to him, he's an interesting guy. I mean, he knows his science. And so in the coming episodes, I'm going to invite Joshua on, explain that meter a little bit more. But if you're interested, go to fox5vegas.com. I'll also link it in the show notes. But fox5vegas.com and search for Joshua Warren. You'll come up with that story. It's interesting. Hey, look, there's a lot about science we don't know about. I can prove that all the time with government documents. They're proven wrong all the time when scientists working for the feds make a discovery that they didn't know the day prior. So who knows? Maybe he stumbled on something out there towards Area 51 that really shows that the laws of physics are being altered and time really is slowing down in one particular spot. So definitely check that out. Last headline I want to talk about is a little bit closer to home. This one deals with the Black Vault. Now, you may not have heard about a new project that I launched late last year, the beginning of this year, around December to January of this year, called TBV Investigations. Now, I was getting a ton, and I mean that literally, a ton of UFO and paranormal-related cases just because of my appearances on television, on a worldwide scale, on various documentaries and shows and so on over the years. And I didn't know really what to do with them. So I started archiving these cases, these witness testimonials. And I realized that there were just too many good cases that I just didn't have time to investigate. I mean, I'm not a field investigator. I don't claim to be one where I go out into the field and take soil samples and so on and so forth. Now, obviously, there's a couple organizations that do that. They train investigators, researchers to go out there and do it. But I wanted to make a different approach. I'm not taking away anything from those other organizations, okay? They do great work. They have great people involved. I'm friends with them. I'm in good standing with them. I am not trying to compete with them. So that's not what this project is about. But rather, I wanted to bring together researchers on a global scale. And I built a complete infrastructure with a case management system in the background, ways to communicate with the witnesses, ways for investigators to communicate, all in the background. While in the foreground, people like you, curious minds, even those that have witnessed something, can go on and see every case that has been put in the system. And there are thousands already that are into the system, all put on a global map. Now, the reason I bring this up is twofold for the headline. Number one is for those who just want to look and read at the case files, do not miss it. Because like I said, there are thousands of cases. Now there is almost 40 investigators in about 8 different countries involved in TBV investigations that literally take on cases, manage the case themselves, investigate it, try and find answers. Sometimes they can, sometimes they can't. But they're doing amazing work. So I want to make sure that you guys know about that resource. Because I'll be profiling a lot of these cases in the coming episodes. To get into that system, log on to www.theblackvault.com/casefiles. And when you go there, you're going to just get spit out thousands and thousands of cases of UFOs and all paranormal related and military related. All sorts of case files will be at your disposal there. So make sure that you look at some of the most recent cases because, again, those TBV investigators, the ones that I have brought together that are really working hard in trying to get answers, they've done a great job. So I want you to take a look at their case files. Everybody writes reports about the cases that they take on. So it's definitely worth a look. The other part of this, though, and I want to mention before we move on, if you're interested in getting involved in UFO research or paranormal related research, you know, whether it be ghosts or cryptozoology, since I get all of those reports, the infrastructure I built, it'd be silly for me to turn them down because investigators, not the entire team, everybody has their niche and interest, but some of them want to take on those cases, and that also might be you. So if you're interested, this is open to anybody to write me. Let me know that you want to investigate. It's okay if you've never done this before. We're here to help. That's the whole point of this as we kind of move forward because it's a fairly new project still. I mean, I'm only about 7 months in fairly new project, but we all help each other. And it's a very cool group of people, something I'm very, very proud of. So if you want to apply as being an investigator and you want to take part in this, send me an email. Pretty easy and straightforward. contact@theblackvault.com. That's the email. Again, contact, C-O-N-T-A-C-T, at theblackvault.com. Let me know about your background. Let me know what you want to do. But we're definitely looking for more investigators and more locations because the case load, the amount of cases that are coming into the Black Vault, is increasing dramatically. So we definitely need your help if you're interested. And don't worry, there's no time commitment. I don't demand that you do 60 cases a day and work 90 hours a week. It's not about that. It is designed to be at your own pace. And those are the headlines. Coming up, Mr. Stanton Friedman in this episode's TBV Dialogue segment. This week on the TBV Dialogue segment, I'm very excited to welcome the man, the myth, the legend, but most of all, my friend, Mr. Stanton T. Friedman. Now, Stanton gave his first lecture back in 1967 on the UFO topic. He's a nuclear physicist by trade, but we will always remember him as the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident. But his story, after me knowing him for so many years, his story goes much, much deeper than that. Stanton, welcome to the Black Vault Radio.
Delighted to be here, John.
I am very excited to have you on this show. Now, I kind of want to tell a quick story before we get going. And the reason is because I love telling the story of how we met. And if you can believe it, it is over 21 years ago that you and
I... Hard to believe.
Yeah, I know. It is very, very hard to believe. But over 21 years ago, I was 15 years old, and I was fascinated by this topic. And I looked into everybody that was involved in everything and every angle and so on. And I tried to write letters to everybody out there, all the big names of ufology. And as a 15-year-old kid, you know, I wasn't sure who would write back, if anybody. I will not name names of who all I wrote, but I will name you. You are the only one that wrote me back as a 15-year-old kid. And here we are, more than 21 years later. You sent me, I don't know if you remember this, you sent me a package of material for me to read on your own dime and your own time, and you sent that to me via snail mail. I still have all of it. And that motivated me to do what I have done. And here I am more than 21 years later, still at it, and honored to have you on this show. And it's a true testament to who you are, because we all know you're an amazing researcher, right? I mean, that's a given. Your history in this field is extensive. But I wanted to point that out for those who don't know you personally, because it really is a testament to who you are as a person, in addition to a researcher. So I wanted to tell you on this inaugural show of the Black Vault Radio that you truly were the original inspiration for me to do what I do. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome. I wish there were more that I could say that I am inspired, but I've been impressed with your approach to things, John. It seems to me you put facts first. How amazing.
Shockingly, there's not a whole lot of people that do that nowadays. And that is what struck me about you in the very beginning, is that you truly, I think, pioneered the original research angle. I mean, a lot of what we hear today, and not to take away from anybody, but a lot of what we hear today is stuff that's just kind of been rehashed or hashed over, or people taking one thing from one person and another thing from another, and then just kind of putting it together, and then they make a blog out of it and they feel like that's theirs. But you really pioneered that original research angle, and that's always what has impressed me about you. And to
just because I've been into 20 archives, John?
Yeah, and the amazing numbers too. I mean, 20 archives. I don't know how many documents you've gone to. You want to take a guess at how many documents you've probably gone through?
Thousands. I don't know. I read an awful lot of stuff, and it comes out of when I was working in industry. I found that I had to get the facts in hand.
Mm-hmm.
I was in radiation shielding on advanced nuclear systems, And there were times when we had disputes about the best way to do this or that. And you got to have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear, or you're going to look like an idiot.
Mm-hmm. I wish more people would take that advice. Yeah. And
well, I think it's necessary. And there's enough conflict in the world without putting fake news out there or thinking something is true because somebody you heard it from and heard it from somebody else. That's not good enough.
Yeah.
And you get surprises. But there's nothing like being, if somebody would pay me, I would have spent full time at archives.
Yeah, would be nice.
Well, the Eisenhower Library, the Truman Library, and the Library of Congress Manuscript Division and all that sort of stuff. There's a lot of great stuff out there. But It takes work. I mean, you got to ask for it, and you got to go there and read it. And it's effort, but it's fascinating. And, you know, there are a lot of mysteries in the world at this time. Ufology is only one of them, but I think it's very important that we recognize that our place in the universe is not at the top of the heap.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and I think that that is the fear for a lot of people to make that realization. You know, I think people like us and maybe a lot of people listening to this can handle it fine, but I think that there are a lot of people out there that want to be the top, and if they find out that they're not, that in itself is the national security risk. And to be honest with you, I think that that is the motivation for this cover-up. Now, before we get into all that, I want to back you up into your beginning days. You touched on it very briefly already, but I want to ask you a little bit more. Before you got into the Roswell incident and really started with your ufology, can you kind of give the audience a little bit of a background of, you know, who Stanton T. Friedman was prior to that?
It's easy. When I was a kid, I read lots of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
When I went on to become a scientist, I didn't read much science fiction. I was too busy working my way through college and university and stuff. Believe it or not, I was a union waiter at a good restaurant in Chicago for 3 years while I was at the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Learned a lot about food that I didn't know, I'll tell you that. Couldn't have afforded to go there myself.
You learn a lot about people, too, during I was a food server and bartender myself, and I miss it, but you learn a lot about humans by doing that.
Yes, you certainly do learn a lot about people. And so I worked my way through school, and I was naive. I got a job with General Electric, and my dad had worked for the same company, American Cyanamid, for 37 years. And I was looking at the charts. Gee, I can retire. Gee, he's got several nuclear divisions. I was particularly interested in nuclear because Enrico Fermi was at the University of Chicago, and I was very impressed with him. Died while I was there, not because of me, but
I don't mean to laugh at that, but I got you.
The idea is that I started with GE with the idea I'd stay with them until I could retire at age 57. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
After 3 years. And the program, many Americans don't have any concept of how much money was spent on these advanced programs, but at General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department in Cincinnati, basically, Evendale, Ohio, if you want to be technical, in 1958 we spent $100 million. We employed 3,400 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. We're not talking about six professors sitting around a table with 10 grad students.
Mm-hmm.
It was a major program, and I was very lucky. I worked. I was one of the younger guys because I hadn't been in the military, and there were a lot of guys that had been, GI Bill and all that sort of thing. And so I was fascinated by the work, but I could see the handwriting on the wall that I didn't see. I told people when I left that I didn't think there'd be a GEAMP project in a year or two because there was no leadership being provided.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the company had nothing invested except the rug on the boss's floor, literally.
Hmm.
There's an old government facility and so forth. So it was fascinating work, exciting. I did experiments down in Texas and at Oak Ridge and in Idaho and radiation shielding. That was my bag, how to protect people from radiation. I went on four separate jobs that all got canceled. Aerojet General Nucleonics, compact reactors for space vehicle applications, and I worked at General Motors Allison Division, again, compact reactors that you could transport from place to place. And the crowning glory was Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I worked on nuclear rocket engines. And I'd say the high point in my industrial career was when we successfully operated the NRX A6 nuclear rocket engine propulsion system out not far from Area 51 at the nuclear test site.
Wow.
And, you know, here we got a reactor, total diameter was under 8 feet. Power level was 1,100 megawatts. And Hoover Dam produces 2,000 megawatts. It's a hell of a lot bigger than 8 feet in diameter. You know, and they played, we had a live, we could listen to the actual test of that at our classified facility. And it was exciting because we didn't have any idea how long that thing would operate. Nobody had done this before. I mean, the exhaust temperature of the liquid hydrogen going in, it was cold when it went in. It was 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit when it came out.
Wow.
We had no idea how well this thing would stay together. You know, it would be shaken to pieces, would dump the fuel elements through the nozzles. Who knows? So that was the high point there. But I got started on UFOs. Really, in a sense, because I'm a cheapskate, I was ordering books from Marlboro Books a long time ago, mail order place. I needed one more book so I wouldn't have to pay shipping. And there was a book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, by Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, head of Project Blue Book in the early 50s. And it was marked down from $2.99 to a buck. So because it would my shipping would be covered for the rest of the order, it was costing me nothing, so what the heck? Our program was co-sponsored by the Air Force and the Atomic Energy Commission, the nuclear rocket program. So, you know, it was exciting, and it was cheap. And the book intrigued me. It didn't convince me, but it intrigued me. And I was surprised. What made me angry a little bit later, that was in 1958 when I read that book. It was at the University of California, Berkeley Library in the early 60s, and I found a copy of Project Blue Book, Special Report Number 14. Now, that did surprise me, because it hadn't been mentioned by that time. I'd read 10 books, some of which were garbage, and none of them had mentioned Blue Book, Special Report 14, biggest study ever done for the Air Force. How come it wasn't mentioned in those other books? And Dr. Leon Davidson, who had gotten it published, had included the Air Force press release from the early 50s, which included the crazy statement, on the basis of this study, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% excuse me, could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. Well, it seems straightforward. The only trouble was I had the report. The unknowns weren't 3% or 6% or 12%. They were 21.5%. That's not 3 rounded off where I come from. You know? And also, they had quality evaluations of 3,201 sightings. Charts, tables, graphs, maps, loaded with data, facts, evidence. And a quality evaluation showed the better the quality of the sighting, the more likely to be unexplainable. That's what you'd expect if the sightings were real. And so that report made me angry. I don't like being lied to, especially by the Air Force. The Secretary of the Air Force was quoted as making that statement. And so that I got determined. I'm going to find out what's really going on here. There has to be something going on if the government lies so blatantly. You know, I was accustomed to dealing with security and tiptoeing around the truth sometimes, but this was a blatant lie. And so I joined APRO and NICAP, the two big UFO groups, to get their newsletters and stuff, to learn more. And you know, somebody at work asked me to speak to their book review club. Oh, I got to know Frank Edwards, yes, Flying Saucer, Serious Business. He was living in Indianapolis. And I got a copy of his book. And then when I was working in Pittsburgh at Westinghouse, I called Frank and I said, Frank, you know everybody. He was a newsman and he did know everybody. And give me some names here in Pittsburgh. You know, I want to go public. So he gave me some names, and one of them was the producer of a radio show called Contact, would you believe? And I was on, and I wasn't as good then as dealing with the nasty, noisy negativist, but apparently I did okay. And somebody at work at Westinghouse heard the program. She had a book review club, and they were reading Frank's book and asked if I would give a talk to her club. So that my first lecture was in her living room.
Oh, wow.
You know, not a big production.
Yeah.
But I did the show several times more. It was on KDKA, which is the biggest station in Pittsburgh. And I got asked one day. These things happened by accident. One of 2 days in the three-year period where I got a ride into work with Joanne, a PhD, from Carnegie Tech at Carnegie Mellon University, and was telling her how much I'd like to speak at Carnegie Mellon. She said, well, did you talk to the dean? And I said, no. She says, he's my husband, Stan. He's heard you on the radio. Give him a call. And so I called him, and a talk was arranged. And it was amazing. The place, the crowd was great, a few hundred.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no nasty, noisy, negativist questions. And, you know, things went extremely well. And it gave me a taste. And the guy whose wife I had talked to, sent a nice letter to the agency through whom he had booked the other speakers. And they booked me. I mean, from him, his last question to me when they were here was, how much do you want? And I said, oh, $100. Mm-hmm. I would have taken 50, frankly. Mm-hmm. But he booked me, and because I knew his wife, he told me what he was paying the other speakers, $1,500, $1,700.
You know? And at that time, that's probably a lot of money. It's a lot of money now, so that's why I'm saying that.
You know, he sent a nice letter to the agent who had booked me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I booked, the agent booked me at the Engineering Society of Detroit. How much more respectable can you get? I mean, I buy Japanese cars, but that doesn't count.
Yeah.
And they were sold out 2 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk. I'll always remember that number. And no nasty negativist attitudes. And that impressed me, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still pretty darn young, but 1,008 people, holy cow. You know, so we had our successful test of the nuclear rocket engine, and naturally, as a result of that, the program was canceled.
Yeah, that seems to always be the case with stuff with success. Let me ask you, because you said that you were at Westinghouse while you were doing a lot of this. Was it weird? And I can only assume, I'll let you talk about it, you know, security clearances. My assumption is you probably had one at this time.
Oh, well, I had a Q clearance from, it took a couple of months to get one when I started work at GE, but all during that time, and I had been 56, and this was in the late 70s. Yes, I had a Q clearance the whole time.
So was it weird? Was it weird to have that weird for you to have the clearance, be working in these security projects, but then on your own time, you're researching the lies and the cover-ups of the same agencies that the companies you're working for are contracted by?
Weird might not be the word I would have used, but I was well aware of it. And it's I will say this. It's one of the things that kept me as honest as you could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to get into any trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I respected security. And, you know, there's a basic rule. You can't tell your friends without also telling your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
They read the newspapers. They listen to the radio and all the rest of that. So I've had people say, well, of course you told your wife what you were doing. No, I never told my wife anything classified.
Yeah.
It's against the rules. I could lose my job. And I don't know where there's a spy sitting around.
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't. Very important. And I know once I had to carry my own slides with me for a classified program I was going to be giving about probably nuclear airplanes, shielding for nuclear airplanes. And I'll tell you, they sit you down, and they indoctrinate you. And, you know, the slides go with you, not in the trunk of your car that you're driving, not the rental car, no, with you on your person. And if the plane crashes, we need your itinerary. If the plane crashes, we don't care about you. We care about the slides. Classified material you're calling. So I was so glad to get rid of that stuff.
Yeah, I would imagine.
So I did once have somebody ask me to go over to his home after a lecture I gave in Texas and indicated that there was an eye being kept on me, but that they approved what I was doing. I was not, it was okay. And that was a relief. I mean, I was not surprised somebody was paying attention, but pleased that I wasn't stepping across the line. And it's something I've always tried to be very careful about. And again, because it could cost my job, and national security is not a trivial matter.
Yeah.
You know, I know some people think it doesn't matter to anybody, but it does to me, even though I haven't had a clearance since those first 14 years, so that would be from 1970 on. I haven't had a clearance. And look, security is necessary for a lot of things. It's like the first spy satellite, the Corona spy satellite. Again, people don't appreciate maybe the first 12 launches. We knew the U-2 would be destroyed at some point, which it was.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably not even old enough to remember that, but it came as quite of a shock on our spy planes.
With Gary Powers. Yeah. No,
yeah.
I wasn't around then, but I do definitely know the story and have gone after quite a few documents about it.
Yeah, and security is important.
Yeah.
You do have to be careful about it. And I mentioned the Corona spy satellite. We knew that the U-2s would reach their limit. There were 12 unsuccessful launches of an attempt to put a Corona spy satellite in space.
Mm-hmm.
The 13th one worked. Now you can imagine how much money we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And it got more data. Soviet military construction. You know, it's just going round and round and looking. Then all the U-2 flights that had preceded it. It
wow.
was not declassified. It went on for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only declassified after it got replaced by other ones. I got a real kick out of one of the things about Corona. They deorbited the film. They kicked it out of the spacecraft. And an Air Force plane caught it like a big net.
No kidding.
Out over the Pacific in secret.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of neat.
That's actually very cool. I've never heard that about Corona. I think one of the things on your point that most people don't realize today, and I'm often ridiculed for saying this, because I've spent now more than half of my life, decades of my life, going after government secrets. But I come from a family who has had clearances, top secret clearances.
Oh.
My grandfather worked on propulsion systems, and we believe we kind of traced some of his research, and we believe that it led into the Saturn V rockets that took us to the moon.
Mm.
He was working at Bell Aircraft and worked on the Bell X-1 and then the Bell X-5 that crushed every record that the X-1 was.
Good stuff.
Yeah, very cool. But where I'm often ridiculed is I actually support that some secrets should be kept. And I think a lot of people, you know, they back people like Edward Snowden, and I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but I have been very outspoken about what he has done and people trying to spill the beans about some of these classified programs and classified, things that are going
on. I'm not for the bean spillers, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, and neither am I, and I'm glad to hear you say that, but I think it's important, and I think you've reinforced it, that some secrets should be kept. And that's going to lead me to my next question to you. So after you read all this material on UFOs, you went from intrigue to anger because obviously you're feeling lied to. Obviously, you kind of went full bore and went after the Roswell incident and really did an amazing job getting out in the field, literally talking to people, going to archives, going through documents. What made you push on that specifically, on Roswell versus, you know, Socorro or some of these other UFO cases? Well, what was it about Roswell?
I got very lucky. I heard about it from a television program producer in Louisiana. I was giving a lecture, and the students brought me to the station to do three interviews. And when I finished one of them, the third one, the producer said, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. And brilliant investigator that I am, I said, who's he?
Yeah.
Well, his next sentence changed my life. He handled wreckage in one of those saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. What?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it came out of the blue, and there was nobody around. He wasn't joking. This was not a casual offhand remark. I said, what do you know about him? He lives over in Houma. Great guy. It turns out they were ham radio buddies, had been for years. And when I later asked him, what did Jesse tell you? He didn't tell me anything. This guy, the producer, had seen the articles in the newspaper back there in 47. You know, Army captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region, and a few hours later, Air Force says only weather balloon radar reflector combination. I took care of that, you know. And so Roswell intrigued me, and I was impressed. I called information. For the young people, that's how you used to get phone numbers. It didn't go on your computer because you didn't have one.
Yeah.
You called information, and the information operators were very knowledgeable. You could say, is that in a nice part of town? And things like that. You know, they would know a lot.
Times were different.
So I got a number for Jesse. Now, I was impressed by him as a person, but also, look at his position. He was the intelligence officer for the only atomic bombing group in the entire world at the time. In the world. The Russians didn't have one until 49. And so you don't get to be that without having a lot on the ball. And General, the man who was head of the 509th, went on. He was a colonel when he was at Roswell, but he went on to be a four-star general. He was vice chief of staff of the United States Air Force when he died of a massive heart attack. Again, not a dink. And so I found out about Roswell, you know, in the '70s. And I first heard about it from somebody else. It was the second time around on what I was just talking about. A woman named Lydia Sleppy, a colleague and I had talked to her son, who had had a good sighting. He said, you ought to talk to my mom. And we did. And she had lived in Albuquerque. And she had the Roswell story to some limited extent, in other words. And so, you know, you do your thing. But it was only after talking to Jesse that Bill Moore and I went after finding people. First year, we found 60 people in conjunction with Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, of course, was Walter Haut. You know, talk about luck, John. You know about this. Every once in a while, good things happen when you're not expecting them. I didn't know anything about Roswell, so I looked, and, oh, they've got a newspaper. I looked in editor and publisher, Roswell Daily Record. Called them and asked, I'm trying to get some more information. I have a story here about something that happened years ago, and it mentioned Walter Haut, or Haut. His name is spelled three different ways in the articles I had.
Mm-hmm.
And I was shocked when the gal on the other end says, oh, his wife works here. What?
Wow.
You know, so I talked to the wife. Then I talked to Walter, and he was a great help. He had a copy of the base yearbook. Which he made for me, and he remembered a lot of the people. He was the PIO, but he also, for those who say, well, public information was a big deal, he was also a World War II bombardier, more than 20 bombing missions over Japan, and dropped the instrument package in one of the nuclear weapons tests in 1946. You pick your best guy to do that, because we didn't have a lot of nuclear weapons back then.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to waste one. If you don't have your instrument package in the right place at the right time, it's a wasted explosion. That's silly. So Walter was very special, and I did check. He was well thought of in town. But Bill Moore and I found over 60 people in the first year after that. I was impressed. with the people I talked to, their backgrounds, and what I could dig out from the newspapers and stuff. And so Roswell, yeah, you could say I'm fixated on Roswell. They love me in Roswell. But to give your audience some idea of how interested people are, last year, the International UFO Museum and Research Center in Roswell had 223,000 visitors.
That's crazy.
From all over the world. I mean, especially when you consider Roswell's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 200 miles from Albuquerque, 200 miles from Amarillo, 200 miles from El Paso. It's not on the way to anywhere. You know, it's not a place people drive by.
You got to want to go there. I've been there myself. You literally have to. It's like
yeah.
you said. It's not on the road, and you take a 5-minute detour. It's out there. It's quite a hike.
Yeah, and so I say that to not to impress people about me, but to let them know there are a lot of people interested in the subject, mm-hmm. or they wouldn't make that. Drag their kids, you know, to Roswell. And to me, it's only fitting, John. You realize that the base was closed. They've got a 13,000-foot runway there. Runways are typically 9 or 10,000 at the Roswell Army Airfield,
mm-hmm.
because that's where the 509th was based, and these huge B-36s were lumbering in there. And
yeah.
there. And so... It's special. But when Lyndon Johnson ran for president in 64, New Mexico didn't vote for him. So after he became president, he closed the base in New Mexico mm-hmm. and moved it to Texas. Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, so it seems fitting to me that they get the benefit of the government lies and cover-up and all that sort of stuff. There were lots of people working at the base, and they were put out of work for no mm-hmm. good reason at all.
Yeah, sadly, that happens way too often around the country. But specifically in Roswell, after you spoke to everybody, Walter Haut and all these people that had the direct connection, to kind of bottom line it for the audience, how convinced are you that it was an alien spacecraft and not some other top secret weather balloon?
Oh,
or...
very, very convinced. Partly because remember that Jesse Marcel had a top secret clearance when he was there
mm-hmm.
as the intelligence officer for the 509.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the government would deal with something like that was to say, look, this is classified technology and we cannot say anything about it.
Yeah.
You know, nobody did anything like that.
And I think that's, not to interrupt you, that's a very important point, because with a top secret clearance, being who he was on that base, anything in or around or on that base that was highly classified, he would know about it. So as decades go on, you get involved, the Air Force keeps changing their story. You would think that he would, you know, in essence, have the quote unquote real answer if it was technology. But what did he tell you? Did he tell you it was alien, just to make sure the audience knows you heard from him?
He had handled wreckage. He saw the pieces of wreckage because Mac Brazel had brought them into the sheriff's office, and the sheriff had sent them to the base, and he talked to Jesse. And he talked to a lot of people, and Walter had talked to a lot of people, and they made very clear that there was no indication from then Colonel Blanchard, you know, that this was our technology. And as I say, from my own working on classified programs,
mm-hmm.
if it had been ours, I believe the word would have been put out to keep your damn mouth shut.
Yeah.
And everybody would have paid attention. Believe me, they would have.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how these things work. So, you know, the story was buried very quickly. But the more witnesses you talked to and the more data you heard, I was stuck.
Mm-hmm.
This darn thing was real. And, you know, there have been debunkers all over the place. To debunk is easy. You don't need to know anything. Just denial, denial, denial. If the first explanation doesn't work, try a second one. If that doesn't work, try a third one.
Just keep trying until something sticks.
Yeah, yeah. And so Roswell, you know, I focused a lot of attention on it, sure. But I was able to get, because I started, you know, somewhere near the top, somebody who was directly involved, Jesse, get access to lots of people and get stories from lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
And what can I say? Not everybody in the world is a liar all the time, which is what you'd have to say if you say the story isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
Do I believe everything anybody ever told me? Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
But you try to evaluate on the basis of who's trustworthy. And as I say, Blanchard went on to be a 4-star general, mm-hmm, and vice chief of staff of the Air Force. This is not a dink.
Yeah.
You know, this is not somebody with nothing better to do but twiddle his thumbs and make up stories and stuff like that. And I did talk to Blanchard's daughter and 2 sons. You know, I talked to an awful lot of people because he was dead when I got involved in this thing. I couldn't talk to him. I would have if I could have, but I don't know how to get to the other side.
Yeah. And after all you've done, and you're convinced. So now, you know, you're saying that you're convinced. And to be honest with you, knowing you personally and knowing your background, that's good enough for me when it comes to Roswell, just simply because I know you've done the legwork. It's not 1 or 2 or 3 people that support this story, but rather, you know, you have talked to an exceptional amount. Let me ask you then, before we move away from Roswell, what do you feel after everything that you've done and researched and who you've talked to? What do you feel the motivation is by the military and by the government to cover this up? And the reason why I ask, other than the obvious one, is it is so blatant, not only with your research and your books, which, by the way, for those listening, if you haven't checked them out, definitely check out the books. You can order them online and see a lot more about Stanton Friedman at www.stantonfriedman.com. That's S-T-A-N-T-O-N. FRIEDMAN.com. Definitely check out those books. But Stan, after everything that you've done, that in itself is amazing. But when you look at how blatant the lie really is, I love doing public lectures, and I start with the most recent explanation, quote unquote, for the Roswell incident by the government. And it is so easy to dismiss pretty much everything that they try and claim about the Roswell incident. It's not a stretch. There's no leaked documents. There's not one guy who told me something in a dark garage one day. It is using their own documents to disprove their own story. Why is that so?
You mean crash test dummies dropped 6 years later aren't good enough for you?
Yeah, and it's ridiculous how blatant the cover-up is, meaning the lies, and you can prove it. Why is it? Meaning, why are they doing this? Why is it so easy to disprove it? And what is their motivation to keep the lie going?
Well, I've worried about that, obviously. You may have noticed, I don't speak for the government.
You're right.
I think there are several reasons. Major one is technology. In other words, if we have wreckage and are trying to learn from it, and if our enemies find that out, then they can put it together with what they have learned, and maybe they can beat us to the punch and, you know, developing a higher, faster, farther kind of vehicle. Secondly, I think that we tend to forget. I've got to look up the latest number, how many countries there are on planet Earth, but I think it's over 190. There aren't many people thinking of themselves as Earthlings.
Mm-hmm.
People in power want to stay in power. And I think that's one of the reasons you don't want to get the world thinking that this is a planet and should have a government, because if it does, then I'm not going to be doing what I'm doing, mm-hmm, says the guy in charge. Also, I think there is a feeling that the aliens at some time or other may decide not to land on a White House lawn, which is one of those silly notions. It's a no-fly zone, you know. but to come clean, and times have changed. Look, the Pope has talked about life in outer space. You know, times really have changed. And the biggest thing is the Kepler satellite, space telescope, if you will. When Frank Drake and Carl Sagan were talking about life in outer space and let's listen for radio signals, you know, and all this kind of stuff, Frank was talking about 8,000, there may be 8,000 places that could be sending us signals, 8,000 planets.
Mm-hmm.
The latest numbers from Kepler indicate there are 1.6 planets per star. So in our galaxy alone, that would be well over 100 billion planets.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying they all have life. Maybe only 10%, maybe 2%. You're still talking about a huge number.
No, even a fraction
also,
of a percent.
Usually the kids learn that the nearest star is 4.3 light years away. But if you look at the total, the neighborhood, there are loads of stars that have other stars much, much closer to them than that. My favorite pair, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, from the Betty Hill star map stuff described in my book, Captured, etc. Those two stars are only 39.3 light years from here, but from each other, they're only an eighth of a light year apart.
Hmm.
The other one is visible all day long from a planet around the other one. That's more than 30 times closer to each other than we are to the next star over. So we're out in the boonies.
Mm-hmm. We're on the outskirts.
The other thing that's changed, you know, Bishop Usher in the 16th century, I guess it was, figured out he was interested in sex. He looked at all the big gaps in the Bible and figured out that the world was created in about 4004 B.C. So it's 6,000 years old. Now we know that the Earth alone is a good 4 billion years old, give or take a few million, tens of millions of years. So that leaves time for others to have developed trips to the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody is going to ask two questions, among many. Are we alone? And how do you get there?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what do they want out there? And when you start looking at things that way, everybody is also going to ask an obvious question. How does the sun work?
Mm-hmm.
People don't realize 100 years ago we thought the sun was a mass of burning gas.
Yeah.
And it turns out it isn't. It's nuclear fusion going on there, and I'm one of the few people can say I worked on a study of fusion propulsion way back in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
And if you got the dough, you can go. That was the conclusion. So I'm saying every civilization is going to ask the question, how does that star of ours produce its energy?
Yeah.
We figured it out in 1938. That's after I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, fission and then fusion. And again, people don't understand how much of a jump it is. These aren't just a little better than a chemical rocket. A big bomb in World War II, and of which there were many dropped, was a 10-ton blockbuster. Released the energy of 10 tons of dynamite. Wow! Make mm-hmm. a big hole in the ground, all right, all right. Okay, the first atomic bomb, 1945, a fission device, released the energy of 15,000 tons of dynamite.
Wow.
Not 10 tons, 15,000 tons. The first H-bomb, a fusion device, 1952, released the energy of 10 million tons of dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians set off Tsar Bomba, I don't know the name of that.
Yes, I've read about that.
You know,
it's scary
over 50,
how big.
50 million tons of dynamite.
That's insane. That is the biggest explosion, right, to date?
Yes. Yeah, and the kicker is, what I'm saying is not to scare people about nuclear explosions, but to realize to any alien in this neighborhood, he knows we could go out and bother them.
Mm-hmm.
Fusion would do the job. And our track record is pretty damn bad, if you pardon the expression, but we killed 50 million people in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
We destroyed 1,700 cities. Would anybody in the neighborhood want us to take our brand of friendship out there?
Yeah.
I don't think so. They'd keep their eye on us. And, you know, maybe you say, well, we're really good guys at heart. Yeah, but look at the evidence now.
Yeah.
50 million deaths? You don't value life very much, do you, earthlings?
Yeah. Yeah, and
I think that's
a huge conversation in itself, wherein would aliens then at that point care to either come here or, if they've been here, come back? You know what I mean? Because if there is one civilization that has the ability to reach us and can visit planet Earth, the biggest question that I've struggled with now for more than 20 years is I don't know if they've been here or not. But if they have, would they ever care to come back? I mean, we are that anthill, in my opinion, the anthill in the middle of the Sahara Desert that isn't worth their time. You know what I mean?
But they have to quarantine us, John.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, well, quarantine, but just by quarantining, they can just ignore. You know what I mean? I mean, we just don't have.
And have us show up on their doorsteps with nuclear weapons, ready to enforce their will on us.
Yeah,
us on them.
But do you think?
I don't think the Galactic Federation wants to allow that kind of stuff to go on.
If and this is an honest question, because I think that this is a big one. Do you think, it doesn't even matter, the biggest nuclear bomb that we've exploded, when the Soviets did it, do you think that that would even threaten them at all? It threatens us, and it scares the bejeebers out of probably a lot of people who weren't aware of the magnitude of the nuclear weapons. But to a civilization who can traverse the stars, and this is an honest question, do you think that would even be remotely close to the technology and the weaponry that someone like that has?
No, probably not, because we haven't been around long enough to develop the ultimate, if you will. But it would be enough to say, keep your eye on the idiots over there.
Yeah.
At the rate they're... Look, we have exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some of them underwater and all the rest of them. Some of them weren't huge. That isn't the point. It tells you something about the civilization here. So I don't think the Galactic Federation Intelligence Agency, I just made up a new alphabet soup agency, would want to let us zip along at our own speed and come out and threaten them.
Mm-hmm.
We're warlike. We're nasty. Like I say, 50 million lives is not peanut butter, you know? So I think there are good reasons for they're not landing and saying, okay, guys, here's the way you got to do business. I think there are rules. Because I think an advanced civilization makes rules to protect its citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't really done that. You know, here at war, there at war, that's the way it goes on Earth.
Yeah.
There's probably a song there.
No, and there absolutely is a song. There's 195 countries, to go back to what you were saying before. So there's 195 countries as we talk. And to be honest with you, there's 195 mindsets of how this planet should be run. And to your point, I don't think there's any unity to that fact, meaning, and the number's growing from what I understand, from 190. Right. So, I mean, people aren't coming together and joining hands and living in a paradise. Sadly, it is quite the opposite, where we have wars going on and different parts of the world and different countries, and people who hate each other still hate each other, and so on and so forth. So sadly, there's just no unity here on the planet Earth. And not to sound a little new agey, but sadly, we do need to get to that point where we work together and figure out, because we are going to have to figure out how to get off this planet and join that Galactic Federation if it exists. We have a Space Force now, so why not, you know, create and join the Galactic Federation? Because I did a show, Stan, I don't know if you saw it, but it was about the end of the world. It was on History Channel, and I got to produce and write this thing, and it was called, between you and me and everyone listening, I didn't care for the ultimate title it ended up. Originally, it was called The End, but it ended up Doomsday, 10 Ways the Planet Will Die. And every episode talked about nuclear war or an asteroid impact or so on and so forth. So this production company called me and they said, okay, we've got an episode. The synopsis is, if aliens come here and their intent is malicious, what happens? And so I got to literally write a 1-hour show on that. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I'll have to send you a link to it so you can watch it.
Yeah.
But my whole point is And that goes to my question to you earlier was, could we even ding their armor, so to speak, with what we've got? Because if they're there and they can traverse the stars, they've got an awful lot.
Well, star travel is not such a big deal. And I mentioned nuclear. I didn't point out that, for example, World War II submarine, you know, U-boats, big threat to shipping everywhere, could stay underwater for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now they can go around the world without coming to the surface.
Yeah, yeah.
We have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. They need a tanker nearby. They can operate for 18 years without refueling, John.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying, part of the picture here. You remember the Malmstrom Air Force Base case. They're paying attention to where we have nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We're looming large in somebody's telescope. Keep your eye on the idiots.
Mm-hmm.
They're out there.
And that's us. In the last 10 minutes here with you, Stan, because I know you're packing your bags literally to go to Roswell here in the next day. So I do appreciate you taking the time. But in the last 10 minutes, I want to talk about today, ufology today, and the state of research into this field. I mean, obviously, the last 7 months has been seven, 8 months has been fairly exciting. We've got news of a secret Pentagon UFO study, which is fairly controversial still. We don't know a whole lot about it. A lot of speculation and rumor out there. We don't know, you know, exactly what it is. But with that being said, it's an exciting time. And sadly, you did announce your retirement earlier this year from the field. And
yes.
As a friend of yours, I'm telling you, you seem more busy in your retirement than you did while you were active. So hopefully you were getting some rest.
This trip to Roswell, which I leave tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
Is my last big trip. I've got another lecture booked in South Carolina, which has been booked for many, many months, and maybe one in California, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm going to be 84, John.
Yeah, well, 84
years
young.
You're not supposed to be traipsing around the galactic neighborhood when you're 84.
Yeah, well, you've done amazing in the 84 years young that you've been around. Let me go back to that question, though, of what you feel today is. Are you happy with what the field is today from the late 1960s on? Are you disturbed? What's going on?
I think it's a mix. There are things that bother me. There are things that please me. I think that I noticed the MUFON Journal is getting fancier, looking good. Serious effort. What I want to know, and you mentioned the release of information last December and January, Luis Elizondo and others, mm-hmm. and the fact that there was a secret program for cost. We only spent $22 million, which is peanuts. But the question I want to have an answer to, and I've been impressed with what I've seen of Elizondo and some of the others, but my question is, where is the paper? You don't have government-sponsored programs without there being reports generated.
Yeah.
It's the nature of the beast. You can't avoid paper. Progress reports, quarterly reports, semi-annual reports, annual reports, technical reports, they're all over the place. We haven't seen one.
Yep. Yeah. And
why? And was it because the original story came out and they were afraid to prosecute the people for releasing it because then that would be admitting that it was true? But they're withholding the rest? I don't know. It bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see those reports, guys.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's been one of the red flags and concerns for me. Now, I will say that the official line from the government side is that the reports, everything that you just mentioned, and this is why I love you to death, is that you know what to go after. So those are the reports that I'm going after, and according to a couple different agencies now, mostly the Office of the Secretary of Defense, everything that you just mentioned would be at the Defense Intelligence Agency. And sadly, out of the entire government, federal, et cetera, that is the worst agency that they could be at because they are roughly approximately about 2 years backlogged. I literally just got a FOIA response from them, I kid you not, about a week and a half ago, that was in response to a request I did in 2014. So that could, yeah. And so, I mean, 4 years on that one alone, the average is about a year and a half to 2 years. Now, so to go back to your point, where is everything? Where's the beef? The official line, it's at the DIA. But once it gets processed, we could wait 2 years for nothing, because that request that I did in 2014, if you can believe it, the responsive records were 100% classified. So I waited 4 years for them to tell me that they couldn't give it to me. So that being said, I'm with you. I want to see the beef. I want to see the original stuff, the progress reports, the quarterly reports, you know. And but again, that's a show in itself. So tomorrow, where do you think ufology is?
I think it's sitting waiting for old guys like me to retire, I guess, among other things. But
no, we don't want you to go, to be honest with you.
Well,
at all.
I'm still at the end of a phone. You know, I can do that easily without. I went to Arkansas several months ago. It took me four flights to get there from here.
Yikes.
That's tough walking around airports, I'll tell you, mm-hmm. at my age, anyway. But I think there is definitely a difference in attitude. I don't get many people saying we're the only ones anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's an old saying, if you will, new ideas come to be accepted, not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're living at a time where we're accustomed to the idea of there being aliens out there. You know, it's not a shocking notion to young people. Oh, sure, we can go in space. Why couldn't they be going in space? And so I'm pleased that I think we're going to be moving forward. And I think there will be more people who take it seriously. I think that there will be more stories. Maybe we won't get the documents sent to the CIA. I'm not an optimist about that. But I think there will be more people who may make deathbed confessions because the ground has already been walked on, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm still an optimist, John. Yeah, sure. I would like to have said 20 years ago, oh, we'll know everything in 10 years. You mm-hmm. know, I couldn't have said then, and I won't now. But I think the tone is right. That is, I think people have grown accustomed to the notion that there are aliens out there. Not necessarily that they're coming here, that the government is covered up, although I always get a great response when I show an NSA UFO document where you can read one sentence per page.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, there's those hundreds of CIA documents all blacked out, redacted.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds so much better than blacked out.
Yeah. And that's why they use whiteout on some of them, so it doesn't look as striking.
Well, yeah. The NSA documents, I got 156 pages of top secret Umbra material. You can read one sentence per page.
Mm-hmm.
And the NSA actually put out a memo, haven't looked at it in a long time, saying that we have reason to believe that some or all of our agencies will receive requests from Stanton Friedman. They gave my address, but they blacked that out on what I got, for information about UFOs. If such a request is received, do not respond as required by Air Force regulation, blah, 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 blah. Instead, send the request to headquarters. If there's nothing to cover up, what do you make statements like that for? You know?
Yeah, they're worried. They're worried that people ask questions like you have done and have done beautifully for decades. They're afraid of that. And I think people most people are just comfortable taking what I call the company line and moving on. They go back to their cell phones and their reality TV, and they don't care to ask questions. And I think, as indicative by that memo you just talked about, when people like you come along and they ask questions and they push back, that in itself is part of that national security problem about UFOs that keeps me curious. I don't know if you feel the same way, but it's that cover-up that is so blatant. I can't lose interest. I can't I can't stop. You know, I just keep kind of pushing.
I know the feeling, John. And I look, people ask me who's coming along that you would trust. And yours is the first name that comes to mind.
Well, I'm honored
you're somebody
that you would say
who's pushed, who's pushed hard. And how shall I put it? Legally, you've gone through channels. You've done things the right way. You haven't disgraced the field. There are people who wail loudly, making all kinds of claims. It isn't good enough to make claims. You got to do something about it.
Yep.
You know, show me the paper kind of thing.
That's right. And there's not a whole lot of true original research out there. And, you know, I could talk to you all day long. Sadly, you know, this is kind of the end of the hour that we allotted for our dialogue here. But I really do hope, obviously, we're friends and we'll continue to talk. But on the air, I want to tell you, hopefully you do realize not only with me how much of an inspiration that you have been because of that original research and because of that hard work. I mean, you truly were the pioneer in this and showing others, hey, don't be afraid to do this. Don't be afraid to ask questions. I can tell you that I probably don't just speak for myself with that. So I hope when we hang up, even though we'll probably talk again very soon, for everyone out there, just know that that you're an inspiration to them too. And I think that for anybody who wants to learn more about Stanton, he really is the real deal. I don't say it that often, as you guys will listen to this show and hopefully continue to listen week after week. It is very rare for me to truly endorse the work of somebody. Stanton is definitely one of them. Check him out at www.stantonfriedman.com. Amazon has you listed, Stan, as the author of 12 books. Is that an accurate number?
Well, I would have said six, but there are some things that some people call books that I don't call books.
I got you. Okay. Well, it spits out 12, I believe, on Amazon. Regardless, buy them all if you're listening. They're definitely well worth it, well researched, and again, that original research that we all know and love. So, Stanton, thank you so, so much for joining me on this first episode. It was only fitting out of this entire field for me to ask you to appear with me on this first show, which I'm very excited about, and there's a lot of exciting shows coming, but thank you for taking
the
time.
It's been my pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And that wraps up my interview with Stanton Friedman, but don't go anywhere, because coming up is that one document I'm going to profile this episode, and it's one that is on the top of my list as not only being important, but it's one of my favorites. Stay tuned for this episode's edition of TBV Unredacted. This week's document in TBV Unredacted is kind of fitting for my first show. Not only, as you just heard, Mr. Stanton Friedman, who I have known longer than anybody in the UFO field. Let me tell you, he's an amazing person to know, not only because of who he is, but of the knowledge that he has that goes well beyond Roswell. I mean, we only scratched the surface. You can only do that barely in an hour with Stanton. But I also felt it fitting that this episode's first TBV Unredacted highlight is the first document that I ever got under the Freedom of Information Act. Now, here's the backstory. When I was 15 years old, like I told Stanton in the introduction, I was fascinated by the topic. Never thought that I would be an investigator. Never thought that I would actually go out there and start filing FOIA requests and trying to get answers in that method. Rather, I was just looking for information online. I wanted to see what was out there, and I read about this document. It had been out before, and it was called the 1976 Iran Incident. That's what it's been infamously known as. And it was a four-page government document, or so this website claimed. And I read through it, and I thought to myself, there's no way that this document could be real. Now, I'll get to the story in a second. So when I was 15, this website kind of knew that there would be some skepticism behind what this document was all about, and people would doubt it. And that's exactly what I did, because there are so many bunk stories out there. I just didn't believe that this one was real. And so it talked about this thing called the Freedom of Information Act. Now, I had no idea what the Freedom of Information Act even was at this point, but it said, if you want to get the document itself, you can. All you have to do is ask for it. Now, I thought there's no way that the government is going to send little old me anything for free. But that's what this website said. So they gave you kind of a form letter that you could copy and paste asking for this specific record. It was only 4 pages. And sure enough, I filed that request, and within about a month, I think it took, the government sent it to me. Now, I was shocked because this document was real. Now, what's the contents? Well, it's an incident that happened in September of 1976. It goes a little something like this. The base commander there at the local Imperial Iranian Air Force base was receiving multiple phone calls from people all around the city. They were talking about a UFO, an unknown aircraft, in their vicinity that shouldn't be there. And they were asking, well, what do you guys have in the air? Well, the base commander tried to tell everybody that they were just seeing stars in the sky. But after quite a few phone calls, according to this document, he went outside, took some field binoculars. Sure enough, he sees the UFO. Now, it shouldn't have been there. All right, that's point number one. He knew everything that was in that area. He was the base commander, and he didn't have anything in the air. So he scrambles an F-4 Phantom jet to go take a look. Now, as it gets about 25 nautical miles from the object, something strange happens. This document says that the F-4 Phantom jet lost all communication and most of his control panels. Everything just kind of shut down. So thinking it was a plane malfunction or something like that, it had turned away from the object, seemingly no longer a threat to whatever this UFO was, it regained everything. Now, that's not my assumption. If you could believe it, the document actually is the one that says that itself. It says, and I quote, "As the F-4 approached a range of 25 nautical miles, he lost all instrumentation and communications," parentheses, UHF and intercom. "He broke off the intercept and headed back to Cherokee," that's the airbase, "when the F-4 turned away from the object and apparently was no longer a threat to it, the aircraft regained all instrumentation and communications," unquote. Now, that's a pretty interesting summation in this document because it was showing that whatever this object was had intelligence. Now, the base commander, once this F-4 Phantom returned to base, scrambled a completely different F-4 Phantom jet to go take a look. And it approached at about 25 nautical miles, the exact same distance as the first one when it lost all communications and instrumentation. And then something strange happened. This time a second UFO appeared out of the first one. Now, instead of flying around or staying stationary, this second UFO darted straight forward towards the F-4 Phantom jet. Now, for any military pilots that are listening, if you see something come off of an aircraft that you're approaching and engaging, and it comes at you, chances are that's some kind of offensive maneuver or a missile of some kind. So the pilot is pretty much nervous at this point, and he arms his AIM-4 missiles to fire back. He goes to fire, 3, 2, 1, pushes the button, everything shuts down. All communication, instrumentation, he has no control of his aircraft or those missiles that he just armed. So now he's a sitting duck. He sees this incoming object, thinking that it's a missile. But before impact, according to the document, it drops down, loops around his aircraft, then jets back to the original UFO for a perfect rejoin. The pilot even says that he thought it was going so fast there was going to be a collision, but there was not. This object was able to perfectly rejoin to that first UFO. Seconds later, a third UFO was seen. This one comes out of the side of the first UFO. Now, this one, instead of jetting straight towards that pilot, it goes straight down, also at a great rate of speed. And right before impact on the ground, it cast a light about a third of a kilometer in diameter, according to this document. Now, this is the strange part. What happens next? And I'm not sure. The document seemingly just kind of jumps over the most important part, kind of the pinnacle of this story, where this UFO, what, lands on the ground? Does it blow something up? Do alien bodies come out? We don't really know. And that's the frustrating part, because this document then kind of skips towards the fact that the pilot eventually regained control communications, turned around, returned to base, saw a fourth UFO. Since his instrumentation was not working correctly, he had to go way out into the desert, turn around for a long approach. That way he didn't crash. It was nighttime. And saw a fourth UFO while doing that. He described it as a cigar-shaped UFO. The original craft, the one, I wish I didn't have this term. It's the only one that makes sense, though. But like the mothership of the original UFO, he described it as apparent size of 1/3 the size of the moon. So that was the description that he gave. The apparent 1/3 the apparent size of the moon is the exact quote. So as you look at a full moon in the sky, 1/3 of that full moon at 25 nautical miles, that is approximately what size this object was. So fairly sizable by a vision, by his eyeballs. And so that's what he saw. Now, the report then goes on after he lands back at base. They go out the next morning to where this craft allegedly had landed or hovered above the ground. Didn't see anything on the ground, but they saw a small shack or house nearby. They landed in their helicopter, questioned the residents, asked them specifically, did you guys see or hear anything last night? They did recount seeing a lot of bright flashing lights through the windows, but they didn't dare look outside. They also heard some loud crashing-like noises. But again, they did not want to go outside of their home to take a look at what's going on. The report ends with the fact that they collected soil samples for radiation and that the results, when available, would be forwarded over. That's a pretty amazing four-page document. There's even more details. I invite you to check out the show notes with links to this document. Read it yourself. It's only four pages. But one of the most fascinating things for me when I first received it, I didn't realize how important this aspect was, but one of the most fascinating characteristics to it is the fact that you can read it. There are no redactions, and it is considered unclassified. Now really stop and think about that fact. And the reason is because the fact that you can read it and it's not redacted, in the coming episodes, and jump the gun on me, don't wait for me to tell you about them, go to the archive on theblackvault.com, go to the UFO section, and look at how many UFO-related documents are considered top secret to this day, blacked out, or in the NSA's case, whited out, and they will not tell you what the contents are of those documents. Now, when you can read this one, this four-page document that's not redacted, not classified, considered unclassified in the intelligence world, if you can read it, what the heck is in those other top-secret documents that we can't? The last thing I'll point out about this incident is this was 1976. This was 7 years after the United States Air Force closed their official investigation known as Project Blue Book. Now, the reason why that's important is that once Project Blue Book closed, the United States military and the United States government alike claimed that they had zero interest in the UFO phenomena. And on that note, they claimed that the UFO phenomena in their investigations of more than 12,600 sightings never saw evidence that a UFO case was a threat to national security. Now, I can tell you there are quite a few examples of that very thing in the Project Blue Book files, but that's for another episode. With this particular document, this proved beyond any shadow of a doubt that the United States military, the United States government, should be investigating this. It was a threat to national security. We don't even have this technology today. For Kraft to strategically shut down communication and controls of another aircraft and then give it back when it's no longer a threat, that is amazing technology in 1976, let alone here in 2018. So what exactly was this object? I know we have drones flying around, and I'm sure a lot of them can handle other aircraft and drones, and you know they can fly in the sky and piggyback on each other, and that's fine. But this was 1976. How many descriptions of mothership-type aircraft, I'm sorry to be a little sci-fi with the lingo there, but how many mothership-type scenarios do you have in 1976 where multiple craft are fitting inside of a bigger one? That is why this document deserves to be the first document that I profile here on TBV Unredacted, because it is the first document I ever got. It is an absolutely fascinating story. But more than anything else, this document serves as really the reason why I got hooked on this topic. And here I am more than 21 years later, talking about this document still, because it is that important to me, but talking to you on the air about it, and I hope you do take a couple minutes and read it, because the implications behind this are absolutely staggering. With that being said, thank you so much for listening to the first and premier episode of the Black Vault Radio. I'm your host, John Greenwald Jr., and there are many more episodes to come. I don't have a set date. They will be dropped onto the channel at random times, including new features to come along. This includes new segments with more information and more data that you can use in your journey as you try and uncover the truth. There's going to be segments where I'm going to be asking you guys for questions. We'll play them live on the air for the guests to answer. And on top of that, there's even a thing called the Vault Cam coming your way. What is that? You're just going to have to stay tuned. So thank you all for listening, and we will see you next time right here on the Black Vault Radio.